from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Right at the beginning of his book, Hector Garcia asks, what is God? Some say God is love or beauty, which is a vision, he says, that's inspired wonder and unity and empathy. But there's another version, which he says is just as real. A God who is fearsome and male, who punishes his enemies and slaughters the unfaithful. And these are the impulses he explores in the book. Garcia's argument is that to understand the wrathful God of many of the world's religions, you have to understand the minds of men, because he says God was created in the image of man, that belief comes from our primate origins, our struggle for domination and power. It's a product of evolution. So God, in this sense, is an alpha God. That's the name of the book. We'll talk about it after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I guess we should say this right up front, and we can talk about it a little bit later, but Hector Garcia doesn't see his new book as an attack on religion. In fact, he acknowledges God can inspire passion and hope and generosity, but you also have to acknowledge the other vision of God, he says, the one that inspires extremism and genocide and religious wars. Garcia is interested in the psychology of religious violence and oppression, and he says the basis for that can be found in human biology and evolution, in the traits and behaviors that made us successful as a species. And a lot of the time, those traits involved dominance and sexual violence. Garcia says that these are the traits that humans used to fashion the gods they would worship. So he twists that biblical idea that God created man. It was man, he says, that created God. God as an alpha male, a dominant ape. Male gods from religions around the world, including the three Abrahamic religions, reflect, he says, the concerns of our primate evolutionary past. Today in the program, Hector Garcia is joining us to talk about his book. It's called Alpha God, The Psychology of Religious Violence and Oppression. And we invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Hector Garcia is an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Texas's Health Science Center in San Antonio. He's also a clinical psychologist at the Veterans Health Administration, where he specializes in PTSD treatment, post-traumatic stress disorder treatment. And he's joining us today from Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Hector Garcia, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to begin. Let me ask you, I took note of, I mentioned that you are involved in the treatment of PTSD for veterans. How much influence did that have, what you were seeing and how you were treating veterans? How much influence did that have on your thinking about the ideas in this book?
A little. I think it certainly underscores this idea of human suffering that we see in religious violence. But I think more so my main influence was reading in the evolutionary sciences.
Let me ask you, so when did the idea come to you, this idea that these were impulses that came from our, you know, primate brains? When did you first start thinking about this?
Oh, gosh, I've had this idea for years. And, you know, having grown up in the southwestern U.S., in El Paso, Texas, which is right on the border, you see a huge confluence of cultures that have come together, and the history of those cultures is steeped in religious conquest, and you know, starting from when the Spanish conquistadors traversed their way across Mexico and parts of the U.S. And so it didn't take a very far look. I just had to look right outside my window to see a legacy of religious violence and how that manifested itself and how that remains today in place.
And so so you just worked your way back, I guess. You sort of started tracing where the origins of this. What is it you wanted to understand, do you think, when you first started?
Well, I think the beauty of evolutionary science is that it's good at explaining the ultimate mechanisms behind things. There are many proximate mechanisms for any behavior, but evolutionary psychology gets at what is the ultimate motivation? What is the ultimate cause? The why? The purpose of a certain behavior or perspective? And in the case of this book, in portraying God in a certain way.
So help us understand. Let's start with the evolutionary mechanisms then that are at play. Your principal argument, if I understand this right, is that humans kind of evolved to anthropomorphize the natural world, which is to say we humans essentially, we project our own traits, our own inclinations on God, as a dominant male in this case. Is that about right?
Yes, it is. And other scholars, anthropologist Stuart Guthrie, for example, he has made a good case for our tendency to attribute human characteristics to God having arisen from adaptation designed to detect human presence in the environment, which may have been very critical for our survival in the past. And in the end, you know, we have a very intuitive understanding of rank among humans, and we process rank information very quickly. Even human toddlers, they tend to understand and emulate higher status people over lower status people. Mm-hmm. So understanding and even projecting dominance, and more specifically male dominance, that may have been very critical to our survival as a species. And that understanding has probably been selected for, you know, imagine how quickly a prideful proto-human would be taken out of the gene pool, say, by walking up to the most dominant male in the group and punching him in the eye. He would be taken out very quickly. And so, in short, we have strong unconscious understanding of dominance hierarchies, and that understanding tends to be infused with powerful emotions, which come from very primitive centers of the brain.
Yeah,
and we can describe those emotions as fear, as reverence, as respect or awe, or even guilt. And those emotions ultimately lead to behaviors such as submission.
Yeah.
Or even seeking alliance with dominant males in conflict, or even mating behaviors. And so you see that in human primates, you see that in non-human primates, and you see that infused in religion.
It's interesting how much of this is about sex, I have to say. And we'll talk about the particulars as we go. This competition for mates, for example. You describe this in your book as the ultimate driving force behind male violence.
Most male violence, including religious violence, is ultimately grounded in mate competition. Ultimately, now there are many proximate mechanisms in between, but males and females, we engage in different mating strategies. Females tend to be much more focused on the quality of their mates, and males on the quantity. And because of that, and because reproductive capacity is limited in females compared to males, males across the vast majority of sexually reproducing species engage in heated competition for females, often violent competition for females. And human males are no exception.
Yeah. One thing you point out is that in many religions, the God is a jealous God, very much preoccupied, for example, with sexual behavior, which we'll get to in particular terms a little bit later. But how does this idea of jealousy fit into the picture in the evolutionary sense?
Well, before we kick the conversation up to our conceptions of God, it's important to understand what purpose does jealousy serve? And that is the ultimate beauty behind evolutionary psychology. So if we can see the optimal strategy for male reproduction is monopolizing females and jealously guarding them, which we see across a vast number of primate species. And so it serves a purpose. But another important thing to understand is that males across species also tend to provide for and protect their young. So evolutionarily, an important task is to ensure for a male is to ensure that he doesn't invest precious time and resources, which are difficult to acquire, into another male's offspring, which is known as cuckoldry. And that's where jealousy comes in. It's not hard to see how male jealousy could provide a survival advantage. It provides a motivation, a crucial motivation, mm-hmm. to compete for survival resources and to make sure that, for males anyway, that you're not spending time risking your life investing in another male's offspring. But God, as described in the three great Abrahamic faiths, is an eternal being who survives without resources as we know them. And so why this God would need to be jealous, that's a question that deserves answering.
Yeah.
And he's also described as omnipotent. And for a being who created the whole world, the whole universe, and all life on Earth, he really should be jealous of no one when you think about it. For a truly omnipotent being, a being of infinite power, should really have no viable competitors. But he is described as unequivocally jealous.
Yeah. Well, let me... you have this idea that evolution has helped humans create different incarnations of God, and that this God has different traits. And I wanted to work through some of these. Among them is the protector God. I guess this goes to what you were saying before, this idea that in human evolution, in the evolution of a lot of creatures, I imagine the dominant alpha creature is the one who protects. So talk about the protector God.
Well, the protector God is based on the protector males of our evolutionary past. And you look at extant primate species, and males among many primate species tend to provide the protection against predators, against other males. And that gets intuitively, with great emotional intuition, projected onto our conceptions of a dominant male God. And you see this transmitted throughout the Bible. For example, in Psalms, it says, "You are my strength. Come quickly to help me. Deliver me from the sword, from the power of dogs. Rescue me from the mouths of lions. Save me from the horns of the wild oxen." I would argue, and I do, that this is a service that dominant males have provided throughout our human and proto-human history.
You also mention other protector gods in other human cultures. The Egyptian god Bes, you mentioned, was a protector god. And there are various examples, I think you say, in Greek mythology as well.
Absolutely. And I think that the ubiquity of that role says something about our evolved psychology. You know, we find examples of the protector God across cultures, across languages, across religions, but we have those commonalities in that description, which speaks to our shared heritage. You know, Heracles, for example, in Greek mythology, fought many dangerous creatures and was regarded as a hero who saved humankind. And those enemies are, I think, symbolic for the predators of our evolutionary past. And in many cases, that's precisely how they were described.
Yeah. Does this help us understand the way Satan or the devil is portrayed? I mean, often seen as a serpent. Is there some deep evolutionary basis for that, do you think?
Absolutely. There is. So the devil could be described in any possible way. He could be describing as temptation or something immaterial such as that. But he is described as a predator. He has all these body parts from fearsome predators, horns and bat wings, at least in Western descriptions of him, because that is an intuitive enemy to us as a species who developed on the African savannah, surrounded by dangerous predators and pressed for the need to ally with those powerful troop members that provided protection from us.
There's this body of research you write about called terror management theory. And it's this idea that we have created what you call these psychological defenses against our kind of uniquely human fear or our uniquely human awareness of our own death. Talk a little bit about this part, because you say this makes us kind of primed as creatures to follow strong, maybe even despotic leaders from time to time.
Yes, indeed. And the inspiration for this line of research, which I just think is fascinating and brilliant, was inspired by an anthropologist named Ernest Becker, who really points out that humans are unique in a way that we have such a vaulted sense of self. We understand that we have a self, perhaps greater than any other species. We can understand that we have a future. We can project our notion of self into the future. And to be saddled with this understanding that self is eventually going to dissolve into the strata and become food for worms is terrifying to us. And so we erected all kinds of defenses to protect against that terror, that existential terror. And so what terror management theory research does is researchers have found a way to prime death fears in subjects by having them write about their own death, write an essay, and then the control group would be write about something innocuous like TV or something like that. So those who are primed to write about their own death gravitate more strongly to religion, gravitate more strongly to religious leaders, especially men. And my belief is that, you know, this has to do with our evolved design. That's the impulse that we have carried forward through so many thousands of years of human evolution.
So how does hierarchy come into play? Because you say that in primate societies, as well as I imagine other animal societies, there, of course, is this hierarchical order. So there's an advantage to associating with higher-ranking males, for example.
There is an advantage, and in some species of great apes, the amount of access to mates corresponds to how closely you are to the dominant male, where you fall on the hierarchy. And we see that in powerful men across history. Men who wielded enormous power, unchecked power, tended to have a lot of offspring. So it benefits us evolutionarily because the men, well, what we've also found is the men associated with those powerful leaders, the number of offspring they had is also correlated to their rank on the hierarchy. So there are advantages in that sense. There are advantages in terms of protection. And that's part of the intuitive appeal to a protector god, I believe.
The idea of fear is interesting, too, because you say that we have this kind of this inherent evolutionary fear of dominant males. So I'm wondering, does that give more, you know, more power to the idea of God? This idea of a God-fearing person is big in the Abrahamic religions.
It certainly is, and followers are expected to fear God. They are expected to not show pride in front of God, to be humble. They are expected to lower themselves in front of God. And this, I find, a very interesting set of behaviors, because in the animal world, being large has its advantages, right? So big fish eat little fish, so to speak. Yeah. And big chimpanzees best smaller chimpanzees. So size has its advantages, and one of the ways to show fear and to appease more dominant members of the hierarchy is to demonstrate smallness by shrinking down, by making yourself look small. And this stimulates perhaps modules in the brain of the more dominant animal that, you know, we're dealing with an infant here, and we have an emotional break on the aggression towards infants that is ingrained. And it also says, I'm not a threat to you, I'm smaller than you. But to do this to a being that is described as immaterial, that has no bodily form, really speaks to our evolutionary history as well. To do this to a being who is seen as omnipotent, who has ultimate power to do anything that he wishes, is kind of an empty gesture, because we can't truly threaten that being. However, rituals whereby adherents lower themselves to their dominant male god are everywhere in the Abrahamic faiths. And importantly, they are also, those displays are also given to dominant men who represent those gods, such as the Pope. You kneel before the Pope, kiss the Pope's ring, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. We'll come back to, I think, this idea. I like, you write about, for example, beards and hats, some of the kind of manifestations of some of these ideas, which I think are really interesting. Let me ask you this before we head to a break, though, and we'll come back to this as well later. Do you think that if a person acknowledges these biological factors, that they then should conclude there is no God? Or do you think there's a way, at least in your way of thinking about all of this, for people to believe in God and still believe in the powerful influence of biology?
I think both are possible. I think one may certainly draw the conclusion that, look, this image, it's really about us. And I think there is a huge amount of evidence to support that. And in fact, you know, a big challenge of writing this book was not finding enough evidence of this. It was limiting the amount of evidence that I brought forth. But then again, you know, some people are able to compartmentalize, and that's fine too in this case, because what is really important is taking stock in all the violent sides of this dominant male god that represents ourselves and that engenders so much human suffering. And that's really the whole point of this book.
Well, one thing you say is that this knowledge could help us make more rational political decisions, which is to say, if we acknowledge that there's these impulses built into our kind of genetic code so far because of evolution, that we can make rational decisions based on all of that.
Well, that's the hope. That's the hope. It requires emotional distance, and that's a hard thing to do. And I think evolutionary science is a really good tool for that. It separates us from the known, or it does what the great American psychologist William James says, making the natural seem strange. You have to separate yourself emotionally to see these phenomena. So the task is not really an evidential one entirely. It's an emotional one. And that involves fear too, because if we give up this powerful male figure, we feel more vulnerable in the world.
Hector Garcia is with us. His new book is called Alpha God, The Psychology of Religious Violence and Oppression. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll get to some of your questions when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with scholar Hector Garcia about the provocative ideas at the heart of his new book. Garcia says the belief in a single, all-powerful God is a human creation, one we created based on our evolutionary past, where we used power and violence to secure our place and pass on our genes. So God in this way is an alpha male, a dominant ape. Alpha God is the name of his book, The Psychology of Religious Violence and Oppression. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here's a question that comes from Jonathan in Bountiful, Utah. He asks, if a single alpha male God results from evolution, why, he says, did it seem to appear so late in history? And why is it not universal? Good question. What do you think?
That is a great question, and you know, when you look at cultures that have more than one god, even in these religions, you often find a dominant male god acting like a dominant male human. I think what happened in the Middle East is that to consolidate power, polytheistic gods were merged into to singular gods until we ended up with Yahweh in the Middle East as being an all-powerful God. And Richard Wright does an amazing job of describing that in his book, The Evolution of God. But in order to consolidate power and politically, militarily, and in order to ensure that petty factionalism didn't break apart the societies of the Fertile Crescent during biblical times, that is how power was consolidated into one single god, and that god led campaigns into battle. He was based on a dominant male warlord of the times, and that was a very vicious time to be living. So I think that god reflects not only our evolutionary past, but the type of man that people gravitated towards during biblical times when existence was very uncertain. You never knew when you were going to be attacked by rival tribes and literally hacked to pieces.
How does sex play out in human impressions of God? I mean, the lustful gods is how you put it in the book. Let's start with the Greeks, which you say were notoriously sexual.
Zeus was a notoriously sexual god. He had... And he was sexual with humans, and he had a bunch of extramarital affairs, and he even raped a female. And you know, this need to acquire this acquisitive sexuality that men tend to be predisposed to with their psychology. We see in gods all around the world.
Krishna,
starting with the Greeks.
Krishna, you mentioned, a supreme being, of course, in Hinduism, also pretty sexual.
Very sexual, and in fact, you know, we see evidence of very primal mate competition in the stories of Krishna. For example, he killed another male. In this case, the male was a demon. And in doing so, he won 16,000 of that demon's females in the process. So he rivals all the despotic kings of the Bible who also accumulated women.
Let's mention those, the Judeo-Christian God or gods, the patriarchs and prophets in the Old Testament, multiple wives all over the place, of course, concubines. So we see a lot of that in the Old Testament, among other Judeo-Christian texts.
Absolutely, and even Yahweh himself was supposed to have two wives, represented as Samaria and Jerusalem. They were described as his wives, and many of the biblical patriarchs had more than one wife. It was not uncommon, nor was it uncommon to take extra wives in the process of biblical warfare.
Abrahamic gods and others, I guess, a preference for virgins. I mean, you see that in Judeo-Christian texts, the Quran, a big emphasis on virginity as well.
Absolutely. And we talked earlier about this fear of cuckoldry in men. And before there was such a thing as paternity tests, men across history preferred virgins because that was the best way to avoid being cuckolded. And thus, the more powerful the man, the more able he was to acquire virgins. So virgins you see historically gracing the harems of the Middle East, of the Incan and Aztec empires, of the Mayans, and countless other societies where men held the power to acquire them. But God is describing as preferring virgins. The consecration of virgins, for example, is an enduring practice of the Catholic Church, where a woman is consecrated to a lifetime of virginity in the service of God. Mm-hmm. Now, that begs the question, an omniscient or all-knowing God should already know if a child is his, and an everlasting God who does not require sexual reproduction to launch himself into future generations shouldn't really care. So these irreconcilabilities are important to note and to question and to try and answer. And I think it just the fact that this God is based on dominant male humans answers that so beautifully.
Celibacy equated to spiritual loyalty. It's interesting you also write about, you say that the requirement that women in certain religions wear veils or burqas or who cover their head or even shave their hair in a lot of cases, that's a reflection of what, do you think? This same
I think
kind
male
of dominance?
Male power, male dominance, the need that powerful males have to ensure that their genes get propagated, and not their competitors. I think it has gone to extremes in the case of the burqa, where every bit of skin is covered, any possible indication of sexual availability is clamped down upon with the veiling, and it all falls along the same lines. Even in Christ is also described as preferring virgins in Paul. It says, "For I have espoused to you one husband that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ." So even Christ is described as preferring virgins. And what you're speaking about is, virginal dress, so to speak.
You know, there is a question that has come up about, I think some Christians say Jesus Christ was one philosopher, one rabbi, one, God, I suppose, who transformed this dynamic, or was supposed to have anyway, broadened the idea of devotion, considered the outcasts, for example, of the social order, the poor, the Samaritans, which is something we'll come to after a break, this idea of being in the social in crowd. But respond to that question, whether or not, in fact, Jesus Christ, according to some Christians, may have changed the old order of dominance and power. How do you respond to that?
I believe so. I mean, when you look at the behaviors of the God of the Old Testament, Yahweh, it's just full of killing, of giving orders to commit infanticide, of giving orders to take the females of the deposed group. In warfare, which is, it just really amounts to mass rape. So this is a God with very despotic tendencies, and the argument can be made that you see way less of that sort of tendency in the image of Jesus Christ. So yeah, I can understand that argument.
Before we move away from the idea of sexual morality, I wanted to ask you, isn't the modern manifestation of sexual morality something more benign than this idea of primate dominance? I mean, haven't modern religious views been adapted to see sexual morality as not just related to, you know, sexual dominance and violence, but monogamy and family and unity and security?
I think it's complex, and certainly, you know, we have evolved since the biblical age in many ways. We have evolved since the savannas of Africa in many ways. But these tendencies still exist, and you still have people controlling their sexuality for God or under the watchful eyes of God, even within marriage. And you also see men using that to their advantage. And that varies across cultures. And I think today in the Middle East you see treatment of women that does smack of the treatment that took place in the biblical age that really confers an immense advantage to male reproductive strategy still today, and maybe even in sects here. So, but the point is to gain understanding of the darker sides of religion, because those are that which causes human suffering. And so I think what you're saying is probably true, although I do agree with certain scholars who say that all of psychology is evolutionary psychology. We learn because we have a brain programmed by evolution to learn. So,
you know what? It raises this question, though. I wanted to get at later, but let me get to it now because it's a decent segue. You hear people like the neuroscientist Sam Harris, for example, and he's just one who've been exploring this idea that humans really have no free will. That pretty much all of our behaviors, our inclination toward good and even bad, all of that's just a product of our biological evolution, that our lives are determined by that. And we don't really have much in the way of any leeway beyond that. Do you agree? Are we bound by our biology?
Oh, that's a wonderful question, and that's a big and wonderful question, and it's a philosophical one in many respects. I mean, if you have a million possible behavioral responses, but you're limited to a million, do you really have free will? It's kind of a question that's hard to answer, but. Are we bound to our biology? Absolutely not. And I think most evolutionary scholars will say that we're not. A good example of that is contraception. We choose not to reproduce and gain the benefit of the pleasure of having sex. So that is an example of us refusing to abide by the hand that Mother Nature dealt us. Eyeglasses, sunblock, these are all examples. Simple examples, everyday examples of how we choose not to abide by Mother Nature and its design. And so I like to point out that all these violent and oppressive tendencies that we see in religion, we can choose not to abide by those as well.
Hector Garcia is with us. His book is called Alpha God, The Psychology of Religious Violence and Oppression. You can join us. Our email address, we're getting emails, is radiowest@kuer.org. We'll get to a few more questions when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Hector Garcia. We're talking about his book, Alpha God, The Psychology of Religious Violence and Oppression. Here's an email, comes from William. William writes, human religions vary widely in God concepts. He mentions animist religions, which ascribe powers to things like animals and trees and rocks, the moon. He mentions the ancient Venus icons that suggest an early worship of fertility and perhaps a goddess. He mentions Buddha as far from an image of an alpha male. Ganesh and the Hindu pantheon, he said, hardly fit in with your premise. What about that, this idea that, yes, maybe there is a thundering god, as a male dominant figure, but there are also, if you look at human culture, there's a wide variety. They may not fit that model.
There are, and I think we can certainly study those gods as well as a model, but even the thunder gods take on human characteristics. There are certain Native American thunder gods that are notorious womanizers that make practices of stealing the women of mortal men and intimidating people with their thunder and lightning. So the other thing is that if you have a religion based on male power, on territorial acquisition, on not questioning that god's authority, it's not hard to see how other more pacifist, more egalitarian gods would be ravaged and made irrelevant by the gods that lead conquest into those societies, which has happened across history.
Mm. So what you're saying is, yes, there are examples of fertility, deities, gods that are more benign. Again, to William's point, Buddha is one, for example. So what you're saying is, yes, those exist in human societies. So are you saying that the alpha god is only present in some human societies, or are you saying that, in fact, the manifestation of an alpha god, this male-dominated god of sexual repression, is manifest in pretty much all societies?
Well, believe it or not, you see evidence of that alpha god prototype in Buddhism as well. In ancient China, you saw this idea coming to the fore, where monks, for example, rose to dominance and marshaled these large armies to war by making themselves sons of God, or the incarnation of the future male Buddha. And even these religions and the men involved with them used a reliable strategy that we see in jihad or even the Crusades, where when a soldier kills a man, he gained the stage of the first bodhisattva, or roughly the enlightened being. When he killed two, the second, and so on and so on. So he got closer to sainthood. So even the most pacifist religions are not immune to this dominant male psychology barreling in and causing havoc and suffering. So that is why we have to be aware of its presence and understand its design, understand its tendencies.
Kind of raises the question, the commandment you see anyway in Judeo-Christian belief, thou shalt not kill. You say that generally means don't kill anyone in the in-group. I mean, if you're out of that group, all bets were off, I suppose.
An in-group, out-group bias is probably the biggest bias of humankind, and the biggest danger and the biggest driver of violence between communities. It's so ingrained to who we are. It probably even ties back to our cellular biology, just knowing who is part of the group and who isn't. And philosopher John Tehan points out, for example, that the first thing that Moses did when he came down bearing that stone tablet that says, "Thou shall not kill," the first thing he did was he slaughtered thousands of people who were worshiping a rival god or rival gods. So, it very obviously, or it should be obvious that means thou shall not kill those in your in-group with whom you have a cooperative arrangement.
Let me ask you more about, this idea of recognizing kin and fearing outside threats. Those are survival adaptations. And you write about this term called infrahumanization. Talk a little bit about that. I found that really interesting.
Infrahumanization is a strategy that people use to make an outside group seem less human. And operationalized, it means I share less genes in common with you, making the enemy seem less human, because we are biologically predisposed to helping our kin. Just think of our tendency to risk our life for another individual. One could argue that varies, that is positively correlated strongly with the amount of genetic material you share with that person. So save from a burning building, you're going to save your child first, maybe your distant cousin next, and maybe a total stranger or your goldfish last. So having genetic commonality is very important to humans, and both in terms of making peace and making war.
But what's so interesting, too, is that it seems like religion has found a way, has found these certain mechanisms to identify the in and the out beyond our genetics, beyond kinship. And this is, you know, you explained, for example, behaviors, badges, and bands. So if they can't be our kin, we want them to be part of our faith or part of our group. And so we create behaviors like pilgrimages, you mentioned, and badges like circumcision and burqas and bans. Bans are another thing that seems to bind a lot of people together, these restrictions on certain foods or alcohol or certain substances. All of this is this the sort of religion's way around this idea of actual genetic altruism, these signals of commitment?
That's a great question, and that idea actually came from Richard Sosis, an anthropologist. And yes, the idea is that it's very costly to cooperate with people who aren't going to reciprocate and who are going to take advantage of you. And so a lot of societies, not just religions, have created signals that are hard to fake, so that if somebody's giving that signal, you have a good idea that they're going to cooperate with you and not cheat on you. But all the same, religions are very good at co-opting this idea of genetic relatedness, because after all, this dominant male god is referred to as our father, and we are referred to as brothers and sisters and God's children, and siblings underneath this powerful, watchful eye of this dominant male god. And loyalty to him is seen as a sign of in-group commitment. And so a lot of times these behaviors, these badges and bands, they are aimed at proving loyalty to that figure.
You mentioned some of the other costly signals, as you put them, gods demanding blood, demanding virgins, demanding genital mutilation. Does this help us understand the sacrifice, this idea of sacrifice? You see a lot of that in Judeo-Christian culture, Christian culture in particular, this idea of Jesus Christ sacrificing himself, or sacrifices, animal sacrifices before Christianity came into effect.
Well, the animal sacrifices I find especially interesting, and making the natural seem strange, like William James advises. Lesser members of many animal species will give up food resources to their superiors. That's not hard to see. Just turn on any nature show and you see that mechanism in action. And we do the same thing with our powerful gods. We make food sacrifices to them. The Old Testament was replete with burnt offerings to this dominant male god. Yet you're talking about a god who is omniscient and everlasting and does not require material resources. But that is what we know, so we do that. And we make these sacrifices very often for alliance in battle. and to secure a closer place next to this God. And that's the part that I think warrants a lot of scrutiny, particularly if we want to do something about curbing religious violence and oppression and understanding it.
Let me come back to something we were talking about earlier, finally, because you say in your book you're not among those who think science can ever just displace or replace religion. But you also believe that we can or should anyway come up with a kind of a different version of God, something other than, as you put it at the end of your book, something other than a supernatural dominant male that we've made in our own image. Say something about that, finally, if you would. We need to come up with a different creation of God in some way. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I wouldn't begin to presume that I would have the answer of what a God should look like. And I do think that, you know, when you study societies that are less religious, such as many in Scandinavia, you see healthier societies for reasons I describe in the book and that we don't have time to talk about here, I think. But I think that it's not as easy as simply outlawing religion or outlawing certain kinds of religions, because frankly, this tendency is part of who we are. We have these tendencies to create gods in this fashion as part of our brain's design. So we must protect against the darker sides of those tendencies. And as I describe, you know, by protecting freedom of information, by shoring up the wall between church and state, which we're kind of floundering in that regard here in the United States, and protecting scientific inquiry, because if you don't even acknowledge that evolution is a fact, then are you more vulnerable to following the patterns that evolution created in our minds and in our behaviors blindly? And that's what I hope that we can achieve with this book, to be more circumspect about those tendencies.
It's Hector Garcia. This book is called Alpha God, The Psychology of Religious Violence and Oppression. Joined us from Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Professor, thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.